Live from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the Total Education Show, the talk shop for teachers, parents, and administrators. Here's your host of the show, Neil Haley, the Total Tutor.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Total Celebrity Show. I'm the host of the show, Neil Haley. You can go to my website, TotalTutor.net, for more information. Twitter, TotalTutor, Neil S. Haley, Facebook, LinkedIn, Neil Haley, Instagram, TotalTutor, Pinterest, Neil Haley, and Google+, and also on Periscope, at TotalTutor. And every week, I'm just shocked that I would ever think I'd get to interview these people, especially when you think about my guest today. When you think of this classic movie he was in, he's been in tons of movies, tons of different things, but he will always be remembered for this. So I'm excited to welcome the program, former child actor, celebrity, Zach Ward. He was the bully from the Christmas A Christmas Story. Zach, thanks for calling, and how are you?
I'm good, man. How are you doing?
I'm doing fantastic, Zach. And so I want to, the first question I wanted to ask you right off the bat is, how did you become a child actor? Tell us the story.
My mom's an actress. My mom's name is Pam Hyatt. She was considered Canada's Carol Burnett back in the 60s. And so by the time I was about 5 years old, I was traveling around the country with her, living the gypsy life of the child of an actress, going from city to city, job to job, and growing up backstage and on set. By the time I was 10 years old, I had seen people screw up good jobs and thought that I could do better. So I jumped in and started auditioning for commercials. And then The Christmas Story was my first feature film.
See, that's an interesting story, because learning from your mom firsthand, it must have been a tremendous experience, Zach. Because I remember talking to people that, you know, had a family member that was in the business before they were. It really gave you, free schooling by getting to follow her everywhere. Wouldn't you agree?
Right. So it didn't come off like some sort of magical ability or some dreamlike quality that could only be attained by the few and the rare. I lived amongst those people. So to me, I was watching what they did. And my mom was performing at the Stratford Festival Theater in Stratford, Ontario, working with the likes of Maggie Smith and some of the greats of plays, walking the boards. And she would teach me Lamb's Tales of Shakespeare, meaning child stories of Shakespeare, explaining what Shakespeare meant for children. A lot of it was very bawdy. It was dirty and funny, very much like Married with Children for its own time.
Right.
So my mom would explain it to me, and then I would go to watch the play. And it was specifically Taming of the Shrew. And there was a joke I was looking for when I was 8 years old that, not to be crass, but it translated my tail in your tongue, which means something about basically blowjobs. But to an eight-year-old, the physical idea of this was silly. It made you giggle,
right?
Just like the word bums makes you giggle,
yes,
when you're 8 years old. And when I watched the guy get up on stage and land his line, he did it with that sort of pontificating air that most Shakespeare is done with. It's like as if everything is beautiful and gorgeous and for you to understand. And it's not. It's meant to be silly and funny. And you're supposed,
right,
to wink and nudge each other. So I was 8 years old, and I'm thinking, I'm inside a beautiful auditorium, beautiful Presidium Theater. And this person screws the joke. And I thought, I can do this better than this guy. This guy sucks. My mom made this funny. This guy isn't funny. I can make this funny. So that's when I saw the little green man behind the curtain. So that was the beginning of me believing that I had the ability to put my own choices out there. And so that's when I started.
But see, that's an amazing story, Zach, because, again, you saw other people doing it, and you probably before traveling with your mom, if you watched television or you watched certain things, you'd say to yourself, you know what, they must be really talented. But once you were behind, really backstage, getting to see everything in action, you're like, why did they screw this up? This seems so easy. And
yeah,
it didn't seem like,
yeah,
they took the profession. professionalism in that I would put in towards this. And this could be the way your mom raised you and different things about professionalism and going to go the extra mile as an actor even before you started. So you started acting in commercials first. And the way you were able to get the parts is that you probably weren't as nervous as other people auditioning, correct? I'm sure because of this.
It was that, and there's also the fact that I was incredibly talented and beautiful. Like, you have to acknowledge that. You're like, being a redhead, you're basically a unicorn.
Yes.
You know, like, there's very few of you. It definitely made it easier that the fear of the performance was gone. The anticipation of what the entertainment world was not an intimidating factor to me. It was just going out and auditioning and trying to get the job. And, I lost a lot more than I got, but my numbers were still good. So I think before the age of 13, I'd done maybe 5 commercials. So 1.5 a year or whatever. Yeah, and I started at 10, so I did that. I mean, I'd gone on maybe 50 auditions a year in Toronto. So that's not huge numbers, but it's good. So then I got Christmas Story, and when I got Christmas Story, it was what we call a cattle call. So there's literally hundreds of kids coming in doing random auditions for these roles in A Christmas Story. And I go in, there's 300 kids, I get called back, there's 200 kids, call back 100, call back 50, call back there's 10, I get the job. And at that point, it's the audition is being videotaped, and which was a new technology back then. And so then I get told I booked the job of Skip Farkas, who was at the time. So he had the lines like, "Nah, your Aunt Fanny, get over here." That was it. And then I showed up on set. They put me in wardrobe, and they brought me to the director with the guy who plays Grover Dill, Yana Minaya. And I had never met the director before then because my audition was on videotape, not in person. So then Yano and I walk up in front of Bob Clark, the director, and Bob then sees that I'm 9 inches taller than Yano. He sees the disparity in height, and he goes, okay, you get his lines, he gets yours. What was it?
Gotcha. So, I mean, thinking about this, take us back to the date. Okay, here's the thing, Zach. I grew up watching A Christmas Story, okay? Or it kind of grew up in a way. It started being on the television, and it just never stopped. Meaning, I've lost track of the years. My kids definitely have grown up through it, and my oldest is only 10. But what year was The Christmas Story filmed?
1983.
So I was 10 years old then, Zach. So just to date my situation, you're just because how old were you? You were 9 or 8?
I was 13. I was 13.
Oh, you're 13. Oh, 13. Okay.
Yeah, I'm 13. 3 years old.
Three years. So we're in the same generation in so many ways. The way they were able to put this together, it seems like it was a movie from the 70s. Wouldn't you agree?
It definitely, that was the thing that was so elegant about the film is, it takes place in the 1940s, the story does, and because it's a period piece, it became timeless as opposed to a pop culture thing. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
Like, I love Porky's was a great movie, and it was funny, but it seemed very obviously of the 80s.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean?
Never. This can just always be because everyone wishes Christmas could be like this. Coming back to a time that everything was safe. But again, maybe not. I'd probably get in trouble politically correct saying this, Zach, because some people might not want to be in that time. But in a way of just looking at the way that story was told and how it was a family and it was about Santa, the story of Santa Claus and the story of a list and the way school was. It just was so well done. When you auditioned, did you have any idea this would be probably the greatest Christmas movie ever next to, I would say, Miracle? That I think that's probably the only other one that would be if you're ranking them.
No, we had no idea. We had no idea because it was, you know, you read the script, and I was a child at the time, but then you don't really understand how it's going to be executed by the director. And at this point, like, let's be honest, Bob Clark had done Porky's, he'd done Black Christmas, he'd done Children Shouldn't Play With Dead Things, but there was nothing in his resume that would say, oh, iconic Christmas film director. There's nothing there.
Right.
And, you know, it's a crazy thing because Christmas Story, as it came out in theaters for a couple of weeks, did okay, didn't do great. Came out the following year in theaters, did okay, didn't do great. But it really started to live on VHS. People started trading it back and forth back in the day when VHS tapes were $80 and having a collection, and $80 was $300. And having a VHS collection was something you were excited about because there were three channels on television. So it became this thing that was, because it was such a brilliant film, and it was able to be watched by adults, it was able to be watched by children, it was able to be watched by grandparents. So the grandparents related to the time that it was shot in, or the time that it, quote, took place in. The parents watched it when it came out in theaters, and then their kids watched it as they grew up, and everybody felt it was their film, also because it was shot from the POV of a child. So it never isolated anybody. And unlike the black and white movies or the films that have that mid-Atlantic accent, it's like, it's a wonderful life, see? I love you.
Right.
Yeah. God bless us, everyone. Like, nobody talks like that anymore. It wasn't a stylized dialogue sense, so everybody could feel like it was theirs. It's them. And because it then went on VHS, and then everybody was trading it back and forth around the country, and then Warner Brothers, it was MGM, sold out their license, their library, and TNT bought the library, and they started airing Christmas Story as a loss leader on Christmas, because who watches TV on Christmas? Nobody. So you basically put up something there that cost you no money, and then everybody fell in love with it. Like it is this perfect storm that, in all seriousness, has never existed before. And will never exist again. Christmas Story at this point, and this is crazy, is the only film in the history of cinema in the world to run 24-hour marathons for more than, 15 years? And the numbers keep on going up. People watch the 8 o'clock version of A Christmas Story on Christmas Eve, then watch the Super Bowl. And they still go out and buy the DVD. They still buy it.
Because they want to play it all during the Christmas holidays. Yes.
Right. And it
gives you that
nobody...
sense of peace, but also your house is so screwed up, everyone's house during the holidays. What a movie to put on. What a movie to put on so that, even their house was screwed up. Oh, we're dealing with stuff, but this family dealt with stuff, and they were able to overcome.
Yeah. Yeah, and it was like, you talked about, one thing I love about the film is it's not really the quest for a toy or a gun. It's Homer the Iliad. I mean, this little boy goes on a quest and conquers his demons. He conquers his enemy. He conquers his fears, and he earns his father's respect. It's at the end of the film where Darren McGavin says, what's that behind the tree? And he goes to get it, and he looks at his wife. He's like, I had one when I was his age. It's a coming-of-age story where he earns his father's respect.
Exactly.
And that's something that everybody relates to. Male or female, they want to be part of the family in that aspect,
Zach, I'm sure I could talk to you for hours on this, but I definitely want to get to other things, and half an hour definitely is not enough time to talk to Zach Ward from A Christmas Story, but also more than just that, trust me on this in his career, and it's kind of like I'm talking to an NFL player. You hang it up after A Christmas Story, what happens next, but I kind of want to go to your character really quickly in a way. How hated were you as the character, especially when you were getting recognized? Because you were one of the meanest bullies ever. The old school bully is Farkas, correct? It is the old school bully before. Now how bullying is a lot different. You were the quintessential.
Right. Yes.
Yeah, and I'll be honest, Gene Shepherd wrote the quintessential bully, and Bob Clark turned him into that. I was just a little kid who wore the skin. But, yeah, it's been pretty awesome. I think one of the genius things that Gene and Bob did is at the end of the movie, I get my ass beat, which is
right.
Brilliant because the audience gets to feel like they could win in life. And so after I get my ass beat and I've got a little bit of blood coming down my face and I'm sniffling and I'm whining, it's perfect because the hat snack knocked off and I'm just a little kid who's a dick. You know what I mean? I'm just a dicky little kid. And it's funny because the way people interact with me is they recognize me, you're the bully, and they get this big smile on their face. And usually the next thing they say is, you got your ass beat. And they're laughing while they say it, and they want to come over and give me a hug, almost to make, like they're telling me it's okay that I got my ass beat. And it's very sweet, because in that experience, I see them feeling made whole from their bullying days. Do you know what I mean?
Exactly. Now, so when you were a kid and this came out and then it started, you would get a lot older. You were probably a teenager to a high schooler when it reached real popularity. So people didn't recognize. So when you were that age, you weren't being recognized that much, Zach, right? Because the movie kind of took an evolution.
Yeah.
So
I also
first
grew up
three
in
to
Toronto,
four years,
Canada.
Yeah,
I grew up in Toronto, Canada. Nobody cared. Nobody cared. I literally took a girl that I had a huge crush on in grade 8 to see the movie Christmas Story. And she was a French girl, very pretty girl. And after the movie, you know, I'm like, hey, so Mimi, because her name was Mimi, of course. Mimi, did you like the movie? Did you think it was pretty cool? And she's like, no, I don't like you so much. And she leaves, gets on the subway, and takes off. Like, that was it. Like, nobody nobody was like, oh, Zach, you are in the
movie. Yeah, I wonder if we go and find her now. She wishes she probably wishes she didn't say that.
I'm sure she's fine with her decision.
Who knows? We don't know Zach in that way. Okay, so Zach, basically, going through this, you probably have done every appearance in the world. But, you, again, life after A Christmas Story. That's what we want to talk about. You kept acting, and you've been in a lot of different things, but I don't think I would have recognized you'd say, sure, the boy from A Christmas Story. So that's the good thing is some child actors look the same forever. You know, while others don't, at least you didn't, so you kind of evolved your look and stuff. So how hard was it to get out of the typecasting of A Christmas Story?
It was easy. It was very easy because as I grew up, I was 13 years old when I did the film, and aside from having red hair, I got the braces off. I got my nose stopped being like a giant rutabaga on the front of my face, and I just turned into another person. And really, Skeet Farkas and Christmas Story has done nothing but help me out because people are such fans of the movie. They like the fact that I'm kind of the lovable asshole. I've worked on things like Transformers and Resident Evil Apocalypse, and I worked with Cameron Crowe and Steven Spielberg, Michael Bay, and they were all fans of my other work because that film is everybody's movie. So
I mean, I have your list. It's unbelievable. I mean, you've been on some of the biggest shows of all time. In certain roles. And what would you say was your biggest role next to Scott Farkas?
Titus. I'd say Titus was my biggest role. Yeah, Dave on Titus was my biggest role, my most iconic role outside of Scott Farkas.
Interesting. Very, very, for sure. Because, I mean, when you think of those things, of the whole process of being who you were and the different opportunities. Do you like, some people think it's good to just be a working actor. You were in a big, big thing in that, and then also in what you talked about, Titus. But you've worked in so many other projects. It's good to be a working actor, right, Zach? It's a good thing.
Not at all. I mean, if your goal is to be a movie star, well, best of luck to you, because it's not up to you. And I'm not Josh Duhamel. I'm not 6'2" and stunningly handsome. I'm what we call in the industry a character actor. So I if I do Transformers, I'm playing a guy from Boston wearing glasses, low-speed glasses. He was an Army Ranger fighting Scorponox. And it's believable. If I'm doing Resident Evil Apocalypse, I'm a Russian military guy fighting zombies. Believable. If I'm doing Almost Famous, I'm lead roadie of the Allman Brothers Band. I'm Red Dog with a southern accent, and it's believable. So if I'm super pretty good-looking guy, I could be playing the lead, but that would be the only job I would get. And if I don't get that, then I can't get a job in those films. So I wish I was better-looking. Everybody does. But at the same time, because I'm not Mr. good-looking hero guy, play a lot of interesting bad guy roles and supporting leads. So I'm working all the time.
As you said, unless you're like one of the 1% of Hollywood, that's the next goal of yours. If you can't get to the 1% where you can't be Tom Hanks, you can't be somebody that, you know, it's right place, right time, got the best role, there you go, you would take this spot. Because then you get to work with such tremendous directors and producers and writers. You get to work with such great casts. Your story's beyond belief working on all those different shows, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Let's talk about your latest projects in film and then your other projects as well. Let's go to
okay.
Do you have any other films up coming up soon that you've been
in? I just produced 2 feature films this year underneath my banner, Grit Filmworks. One that I directed called Restoration. So one film is called Bethany with Shannon Doherty and Tom Green and myself. And I produced and wrote that one. It's directed by James Gunn-Bresick. And then the other one's called Restoration. And I wrote and produced and directed that one. And
wow.
I'm also in that one. And that stars Emily O'Brien and Adrian Gaeta. So I'm just finishing up post on that. And both Restoration and Bethany will be coming out next year. So by all means, check out my website, Grit Filmworks. It's just got up there right now, so there's not a ton of information, but there's contact data there. And if you want to follow me on Twitter, it's TotalZachWard.com. So that's what's happening film-wise. It's been good work. I have another movie I wrote that is going into principal photography in January called The Terror of Halloween. It's going to be really cool. Very excited about that. But then there's the sports thing
project,
that I'm
Freddy
doing.
Freddy versus Jason, so you probably learned a lot. By being able to write and produce, it's because you've worked on such great things, right? You've learned, you've been like a sponge,
you know,
and soak things up. Yeah,
you soak up a lot, but at the same time, writing is about writing and then writing it again and over and over and over and over and over again and not being daunted. Like, I've probably written 20 scripts in the last, 12 years.
Okay.
And maybe 4 of them have been produced, but that's okay. I mean, it's a lot of work, and you do it because you love it, and you get better in every single time. And you can't really do any of that unless you just do that. You have to read, learn how to do it, write it. It's going to suck. Then you edit it. It's going to be better. Then you edit it again. It's going to be better. Then you forget about it. Go write something else. Then come back to the first one, rewrite it, and then forget about it completely and go on to something else. And then years later, you sell it. Or, you know, it's a process. You know. It doesn't happen overnight. Writing is doing. But I love it. I adore it. Film and producing and directing is going fantastic. Then also in the sports world, we've got I'm doing this interesting thing called SIPA. I'm sponsoring an initiative in California for doing a California constitutional amendment to open up sports markets. As an alternative, so sports market is basically like NASDAQ for sports. So you invest in your teams as opposed to gambling on the side. If anybody wants to check it out, go to it's pretty cool. It's amazing because this has never existed in the history of mankind. Ever since we've had chariot races, there's a bookie on the side taking bets. And when there's a bookie on the side taking bets, it messes with the integrity of the sport. Somebody's taking a dive somewhere. Some referee is doing something dirty.
Right.
Some jockey on that chariot racing course is whipping the other driver. It's ubiquitous.
They have so much money because the bookies have so much money. And they can get somebody part of the game. And you also can look at that in specific things like boxing and UFC and all that. By taking that middleman out, how's that going to change things, Zach?
Well, it's also not just taking the middleman out. It's taking out the one event experience. So if you have, let's use the chariot races. If you've got your favorite team and there's other teams from around the country and they're all in ancient Rome battling it out at the chariot races, but there's a season of chariot races, not just one chariot race, a season. You're investing in your team doing well over the season. No one person is going to throw a game. No one person is going to throw a race to benefit that one race because it doesn't benefit the season. So there's no motivator for any skullduggery, which obviously we noticed it didn't work that well with FIFA.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? They just got international BS and they're going to prison and facing massive fines. Obviously, it's been a problem around the world. Sports gambling causes problems with sports. It's just there. And there's never been the mechanism. There's never been the technology to do sports markets before. It hasn't existed. Just like the cell phone, the smartphone in your hand with apps didn't exist 20 years ago. It's a new thing. So this is it's exciting because if you remember when they opened up the stock market in New York City, was it 1817? It did really well for that city. New York did very well, as did business across the entire country and the world, because people could invest in what they wanted to invest in.
I see. So keeping it away from just illegal and only certain areas helps things tremendously. I'm definitely before that. I'd love to be in Pittsburgh and be able to gamble on sports, but I know you're trying to get it to California first, but that could hopefully become a national initiative. Zach,
I'd love
information
to be in Pittsburgh and to be able to invest in your team. And as you're sitting there investing in your team, getting excited about it, you can be proud about this when you talk to your 4-year-old, your 5-year-old, your 10-year-old kid. You don't have to be ashamed that daddy's a scumbag going down to the bar to bet on some team with Joey the Fish. No,
I agree.
He's investing in his team like stocks, and his son or daughter learning about how economics works.
All right, best place we can find info on that quickly, Zach. Where can we go?
That's going to be thesportsvote.com.
All right, fantastic. And give us one of your favorite sayings from A Christmas Story as the boy. Do it. That one line.
Cry, baby, cry.
Do it one more time.
Right.
When I tell you to come, kid, you better come. What? You gonna cry, cry, baby? Cry, cry, baby. Cry.
That was fabulous. You're awesome.
That's creepy, actually.
Because you're
pretty
performing
creepy.
Other film. We're going to have to connect again when you're promoting another film, get some of your actors on. I'd love to do that.
Oh, you got
if
it.
You ever want, if you're ever looking for a 6'10", almost 300-plus-pound man to be in one of your films, call me. I will be there in a second.
I'm always looking for a Sasquatch.
I'm on it, man. I want to get back out. I was talking to Eugene Bondurant, who was in Hunger Games. She said, I got to get an agent because I have the size. I was a former pro wrestler for so many years. So stay connected, Zach. We're going to definitely stay connected. So thanks for calling in. Thanks for being on the show.
Hey, a pleasure, man. I look forward to talking to you soon.
All right, take care, man. Okay, see ya, bye.
See ya.
All right, that was the Total Celebrity Show. Take care, guys. We'll talk again, man. Bye.
my website, TollTutor.net, for more information. Twitter, TollTutor, Neil S. Haley, Facebook, LinkedIn, Neil Haley, Instagram, TollTutor, Pinterest, Neil Haley, Google Plus, and also on Periscope at Total Tutor. And we're right now waiting for our guest, and I'm so excited for our guest. So excited to welcome the program, and as I'm about to connect him, NCAA All-American, NBA All-Star, Kenny Anderson. Kenny, thanks for calling, and how are you?
Oh, man, it's a pleasure. How you doing?
I'm doing fantastic, Kenny. And when I think of you, watching you, especially with Georgia Tech, you were just such an awesome player. So exciting to watch. I've never seen guards like the way you were able to do things, man. I think of you as like one of those kind of playground legends came. And when you played for Georgia Tech and then the NBA, you were just so exciting of a player. I just wanted to tell you that. Starting out, how old were you when you first touched a basketball?
I was about 6 years old. My sister used to take me to the playground just to babysit me. You know what I mean? And I just to throw the ball up, and always if the big guys wouldn't let me use the ball. And eventually my sister got me a basketball, and it just went from there. You know, I just was blessed to play the game, man. What I really was a student of the game. You know, I grew up from 1-9. I grew up in Jamaica.
Okay.
New York. Higher State. It's a junior high school, and then they had a park in the back that everybody played at. And, you know, when I wasn't playing, I just sat on the ball and I watched the big guys, you know, play basketball, just picked up little things and of that nature. But and then I moved to left rack when I was 9 in 1979. And that's when I met my mentor, Vincent Smith. And he, you know, I always had the skills and the knowledge to play basketball, but I didn't know how to play the right way because I was very good handling the ball.
Right.
So my kids of my age, I would never pass them the ball. I would just penetrate and throw up floaters, throw my left hand, finger rolls and stuff like that. And scored a lot of points against my age bracket. And my mentor was like, that's just not how you play. You know, I didn't want to pass. And he just taught me how to play the game the right way at the point guard position and also my work ethic.
Interesting. So that mentor said to you, first of all, you can't be playing. You got to play a little higher competition, and you got to play the game. You could score against people that your age, but as I've talked to a lot of playground legends, Kenny, it was time for you to hit the playgrounds, correct? And play against better competition.
I went from there. You know, I played in Our Lady of Angeles, the CYO league. And then I played in the playground an awful lot because that's where, you know, nothing was sweet back then for me being home. You know, I lived in an apartment, you know, the TV worked half at the time. But it wasn't, I would always be in the street. I would always be in the, and that's where I, you know, the Smith family, Kenny Smith,
right,
who's a TNT analyst, and Vincent Smith, who's my mentor, I would go up to their apartment. And, me and him would talk about a lot of different things. Vincent, he would give me interviews on how to carry myself, things of that nature. So it was a lot of things that went on, positive things that went on, you know, at Smith's apartment. Then I saw Kenny Smith, how he was raised with his mother and father. All the trophies he had, I wanted to, you know, do the same. And in order to do that, I had to work. So I worked hard at my craft early, you know, my skill early in the gym, and academically also, because he was a pretty good student. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of took after him. Whatever he did, I wanted to do it. I wanted to do it better.
Interesting you talk about academically. So you really looked at Kenny as a great role model for you to say, well, he sees how important academics is. He's trying to play the game the right way, and he's training and all this stuff. So you said you wanted to kind of emulate him, it sounds like, in a lot of ways.
Yeah. One thing I wanted to be called an All-American.
Right.
Whatever that was. At the time, I was a kid.
And is Kenny Smith, how much older is he than you, Kenny? How much older is he than you, Kenny? Kenny Smith.
about five, about not even, he just turned 50.
Okay.
He just turned 50. I'm 45. He took me about 5 years. So I was, you know, impressed at everything he did. He was my role model.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody I looked at, you know what I mean? And he went off. He went to Archbishop Molloy High School. I wanted to go to Archbishop Molloy High School. You know, the only thing I didn't want to do, like him, he went to North Carolina, and then I went to Georgia Tech. So it was a lot different. But we were different basketball players. I think me, I was a very skilled ball handler. I was real crafty around the basket.
Right.
I couldn't jump like him. He was a very explosive jumper, and he was quick. He was like, you know, he was a jet. So we were different players. So, you know, for me to go to North Carolina, I don't think it would have benefited me. I went to where I was going to be able to showcase my talent.
And that's so true, Kenny. And when we talk about Kenny Smith and you're watching him, when you're sitting there, you know, in high school, watching Kenny Smith play, in the next level for North Carolina and stuff, or even earlier than that, maybe in middle school, you were just saying, I got to be there. And that's what kept you driving you, especially when he left. When he finally, you know, left and signed with North Carolina and went on, you were saying, you're watching TV and you're saying, this is where I want to be. You said you wanted to be an All-American. And so that was your drive, it sounds like, for sure.
Yeah, that was my drive somewhat. But then when I got to Molloy, that was my drive. My drive was I can't fail. I was scared of playing in school. I was scared of failing out of school academically, and I was scared of letting people down because I was rated and like number one player in the country. So that was my drive. It was like I don't want to fail, and I don't, you know, I don't want to go to another city. Guys know I'm number one, so a lot of guys will come after me. Played, you know, very well.
Definitely,
classified as the number one player. And after we played, you know, guys, you know, had to give me my respect and my just due. Like, okay, yeah, no wonder he's number one in the country. And that's what I was all about. I was just, you know, and that's what motivated me. I think on top of it, Kenny Smith, and it's that him doing well, I looked at it and like, wow, okay, he's doing this, he's doing that. I'm going to do that. But the thing was that, you know, failure. Nobody wants to fail.
Right.
You know, when you have so much success early, and this is where I talk about in my documentary that'll be out soon, is, you know, being a child prodigy, is having everything so early. I was really scared to fail. And if I failed, I wouldn't be able to take care of my mother. So it was very dear to me, my mother. You know, who was there for me, you know, when we had nothing. It was just me and my mother, and she made it work. So I was like, I'm going to make it, you know, to the highest level I could make it, because NBA, they're able, you know, with the
right
infrastructure and everything, you're able to make money, and I was able to take care of my mother. And that was my motivation there. That was it. And everything else from there was a bonus.
Well, definitely, it seemed like it was a bonus for sure. But you were afraid of failure, and I think in the documentaries we're going to talk a little bit more about your career, because definitely we don't have enough time of all the stories you have, and that's why it's going to be great to see your documentary. Is the fact that through the stress you put yourself under at that time to not want to fail, afraid that what would people think? Is that because of specifically? Yeah. That's got to be hard on you. That's got to be hard on your body their whole life.
Hard on.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's hard on a kid, a young. But in jazz, I had Pierre Turner, who was a judge, who was a mentor with Vincent Smith. They were in my neighborhood. They watched over me, took care of me. Then I went to Molloy, Jack Curran. I had a great supporting cast that really was, you know, no hit defenders, that was in it for my best interest. And it just, I got it early. You know, I figured things out early. And I think that's what helped me a great deal. You know, when you succeed at something at an early age, it can be a curse. It can be a gift. It was a gift for me. And to hang on and then, you know, have a great 2 years at Georgia Tech, and then to hang on regardless of how you feel about, you know, the expectations of, oh, Kenny Anderson maybe could have been a better pro. I played 14 years and was an all-star.
Yeah. Yes.
And, you know, under all the circumstances, I think I had a great career. I had a great career. I can say, but all the things that I had to go through, now I'm living a productive, you know, life in Florida. I haven't failed my mother. Rest in peace. You know, she passed away in 2005, and she would be proud of me. You know,
definitely
to see where I'm at now as a human being, not so much as a basketball player.
I completely agree, Kenny. And a lot of times, basketball sets up for the game of life. Whatever you did, and as at one point it has to stop, and you have to put your plans and how you're gonna give this message out. And through your documentary, you're able to say, you know what? Even though, and that's the greatest thing, as you said, is fail. You were afraid of failure. You were considered the best basketball player coming out of high school. You had an unbelievable career at Georgia Tech. People were expecting.
Yeah.
Hall of Famer. And what people don't understand is it's the right place, right time, right team. If you go to the right team, we could be talking something different about Kenny Anderson. Isn't that correct? For our listeners to understand where you're placed and what team you play for is huge.
Yeah, exactly. It's like in the NBA, you know, I mean, people that care and people that have the ultimate confidence in you. I went to a very, very mediocre, very good team. With the New Jersey Nets.
Right.
But you have to look at the organization. You have to look at the stability of the organization. I think it's really stable. And we made the best out of something. Myself, Derek Coleman, dropped Benjamin. And things didn't just, I wish, you know, I think about it a great deal. What if Drazen Petrovic wouldn't have died and me, Derek, and Drazen would have stayed together for a few more years? It would have been different. But I move on and move, played for Boston Celtics for 5 years. Got my handprint on that team, you know, took them to the Eastern Conference Finals, had great numbers. Went to Portland and did very well. So every team I played on, there was a shining light and a glimpse of Kenny Anderson. I held my own wherever I went. And regardless of the circumstances of how many minutes I played, I like to say 11 years I played. I played 14. 11 years I played 35-plus minutes.
Yes.
That's what I was playing my minutes. In the last 3 years, I didn't play the normal minutes that I was capable of getting, maybe because of all different reasons. That's the nature of the business. And when you get into the NBA, money, contracts, and people differences come into place, and you really don't have no control over it.
That's so true, Kenny. And I'm glad you talked about specifically enough your career. And you're right. I remember that Nets team. And you, when I think of the New Jersey Nets, I think of Kenny Anderson because that team was a pretty good team, and you were changing the atmosphere. But a point guard, in a lot of ways, if you want to be the greatest superstar in the world and a Hall of Famer, it depends who's around you, what players you surround you with yourself, and you are unselfish. Kind of explain that to people, that a lot of times point guards, in a lot of ways, especially to continue to play in the NBA, have to be unselfish, deliver the ball to the best players. And then sometimes you don't get the accolades because of that.
Yeah, that's NBA is very difficult, especially if you're going from team to team. I went to the New Jersey Nets. I came in. It was my team. Me and Derek's team, I had the ball in my hand, great for the time. And then I went to the Boston Celtics where, I had to give it up. I was playing with one of the greatest, as we go down, one of the best Celtics ever, Paul Pierce.
Yes.
And Vaughn Walker. So those guys need the ball. So I had to adjust my game. I had to be a floor general, and I did. I was able to. So I'm so proud of what I accomplished with any team I played on. I had to adjust my game, and I did. And I was able to still, put up decent, put up great numbers and also be a leader and get the respect from my teammates and every team I played on. So that says a lot when you're dealing with the NBA.
And that's true. Or else if you aren't a team player and you're not like one of the biggest superstars ever, meaning after 5-6 years, your skills diminish some, then you're not going to play a long career. Because if you're not a team player, you're gone. And that, I've talked to so many NBA players.
Oh, yeah.
You're out of there. See ya.
Yeah. Yeah, you got the NBA is the NBA. It's personal. So I think a lot of young got out.
Yeah.
And, you know, I had a great run, 14 years, and time to give it up. And, you know, I think with all the trade, I got traded twice. I think getting traded from Portland hurt me. You know, getting traded from Boston killed me.
Right.
You know, it took the passion. It took the passion out of me, you know, when you keep getting traded. But things that you don't know, you know, why, because you're playing some of your best basketball. So I was baffled a few times, and I was like, wow, I don't understand. But that's what happens. And I think after 14 years, and my mother had passed away in 2005, that's when I retired. I said, well, my mother, when I was at the funeral, and they put my mother in the ferry, I said, you know what? God is telling me something. This is it, man. My mother saw my whole career.
Yes.
You know, time to do something else. And that's when I stopped playing, for a cause. You know, I lost the passion for basketball, and I was 35 years old. So, you know, I thought, I still believe it. God, you know, let my mother watch my whole career, mm-hmm. and everything was done.
And when you were in the NBA, people have to understand there were a lot of superstar college basketball players that I've interviewed that did not stay long in the NBA and headed out overseas. So in a lot of ways, staying the course and staying and playing, I remember talking to Tracy Murray the same thing about it. He stayed the course and played, but other guys left. They were huge college basketball stars around you at that time, in that time period, but because they weren't getting the playing time and they found a place to make money in Europe, they left. And so that's the other part of people understand about NBA. Some of these great college basketball players never became superstars in the NBA just because they weren't on the right teams and the right fit. Right, Kenny? Isn't that true, too?
Yeah. Yeah, you got so much priority you got to take care of. First and foremost, you got to take care of your body. You got to work extremely hard. And you got to keep your work ethic. I think if you let the lifestyle and the money, you know, get a hold of you, you kind of slip a little bit. And I think I slipped a little bit, but I was able to grab myself with my talent and, do well for 14 years. Some guys can't handle it. I played I went overseas only 6 months, five months when my mother passed away to get out of the country, played in Lithuania. It was great for me to get away. I did all my focus and all my trying over in Lithuania, you know, because I was over there, and I played, and I wasn't a big fan of older team basketball, but they respected me. They respected me. I did okay, but I didn't really like it, but it was something to do. It was something to do. I took my family over there. And for 5 months, and grieved over there. And the thing, I was mentally somewhat healthy in the mind, somewhat. You know?
Life after basketball, which I know the documentary is going to discuss as well, Kenny. Is that a challenge at first when you finally have to hang it up and do something else? We see so many professional athletes that have performed so well on the court, the football field, the baseball diamond, yet when they have to make that decision, especially when this is the way to get you out of poverty, get you out of to take care of your mom, to take care of your family, and the pressures that you talked about and the challenges you dealt with. Life after, finally, you made it. You did all those things. You had a successful college career and NBA career. Now it's time to do something else. Was that a challenge at first?
It's hard. It's hard because, you know, dealing with when you're playing professional basketball, you travel. everything you need is there. You got your trainers. Mm-hmm. You know, you got it's a structure. 3-4 hours a day of practice every day. You know, You wake up, you know, you have probably a team meeting, you have practice, and that's for, you know, you're with your team 9 months out of the year.
Exactly.
Maybe it's a very good team of playoffs on the team of 12, you know, out of the almost a year. And when you're no longer doing it, there's no more structure there, and you're lost. And I was lost for about 2-3 years, and, you know, kind of depressed at times, just didn't know what I wanted to do. But I know I needed to do something that positive, that helped, to give back. And I just tried to reach out. I reached out to the youth. Mm-hmm. So, you know, with coaching AAU basketball, starting a program, having a South Florida Elite AAU program, I'm helping them out in Florida. Doing my documentary, I just kind of coaching high school, and giving back to some of these, you know, Vincent Smith and Jack Curran and Pierre. All of them.
Yeah.
Back. Okay, this is what I had, gave me and wanted me to strive for. You know, this is the DAC. So that's what I've been doing. It's very difficult. Some guys can't find themselves, and they find themselves through, you know, alcohol, drugs.
Yes.
Their lifestyle gets very difficult. But, every day is different. You got to take one day at a time, and you got to, what's best for you? You know, I got kids. Live a productive life. I want them to see their father in a good light. So I try to live, you know, by my kid's standard and my mother. You know, I always try to, before I do anything nowadays, if it's crazy or whatever, I try to talk to my mother, you know, be like, hey, what would my mother think of me right now if I'm doing this? You know what I mean? And, you know, it's just, you know, just trying to live a productive life and give back a good message to some of the youth. And maybe if I can do that, hey, you know, you can't save the world.
Right.
Maybe I could save one kid. And all I ask of him is how, you know, come, grow, do what you do. Do what I helped you. And go help somebody else. You know, that's what it's all about. I think I get more out of my heart, my soul, by helping
yes.
some of these kids, and this is what my documentary is about.
Yeah, I'm glad.
You know, give it back.
Yeah. I'm glad you did that. You're doing that because you saw that, you know, and I think that also you want this documentary to show that it's not easy to become the one of the best basketball players in high school and considered one of the
at a young age.
And an All-American in college and being able to handle going to the NBA and still having a successful career, but ultimately saying life wasn't simple. It wasn't easy. And telling these kids that are in the AAU programs or, you know, different basketball programs, just because you're good doesn't mean you're going to be ready for life. Isn't that true, Kenny? That's probably one of your ultimate missions to tell people.
Yeah, and that's my slogan. I was sitting around and we were doing a documentary, and my slogan is basketball is easy, life is hard. So it was one of the best slogans that I feel fits me, and it fits my documentary. Basketball is easy, life is hard. So, and now, you know, define me, you know, it didn't define me. It was something I did very well. But now it's time to, you know, give back. I went back to school and got my BA because, you know, after 20-some years, I got my BA down at St. Thomas University here in Miami in 2010. I wish my mother was here to see it. But, you know, she passed. And when they called my name to get my diploma to come up on the stage, it was kind of almost better than getting that hat that David Stern announced when I was the number 2 pick. It was more surreal than that, man. It was the greatest accomplishment that I ever done in my life because I didn't think I could do it. So I went back and got it. And I got my, you know, my BA at St. Thomas University in 2010. So, you know, just trying to round out, I'm not, no one's perfect.
Right.
Trying to do it the right way. trying to do it the right way.
So the question, Mr. Chibs, explain that, how that happened, how that became that nickname. Yeah.
Mr. Chibs is very dear to me. He doesn't mean anything. My mother, when they bring, you know, the baby in, when they brought me into her, well, you know, when she had me, probably about 5 days old or whatever, she said she's eating. And she said Cheeks. And it came and she said Cheeks. And then she said Chibs. And it just stuck with me and my family and my friends and everybody in New York that called me Chibs. You know, and then I didn't know my name was Chibs until kindergarten. I didn't know my name was Kenneth until kindergarten when my mother was registered to me. I didn't know who was Kenneth. And she said, your name's Kenna. And I said, oh, wow, I didn't know. I thought my name was Chip. And every time I did something great, like do well in school or did that, she said, oh, look at Mr. Chibs. Mr. Chibs, you had a good Mr. Chibs out there playing Mr. Chibs. So it stuck with me, man. And she would probably be happy that, you know, I'm naming the doctor.
Definitely. And
it's
so
really dear to me.
And again, we don't hear that. Yeah. We didn't hear that when it Georgia Tech that much, unless they had a story on you. We didn't hear that in the NBA.
Yeah.
So it's great that you're bringing the backstory to people. When is the documentary looking to be released? And where's the best place we can find information on you, Kenny, about it and all that?
Yeah, my documentary, Mr. Chibs, you can find out on my website, MrChibs.com. I want to, you know, thank Skyscraper Films. Who really came to me with the idea and invested their money. And my great director, Jill Campbell, who's doing a hell of a job, you know, with it. She's been filming for the last 3 years. Jill Campbell's just awesome. And my business partner, Barry, who's invested a great deal in it. Greenface, he's been doing a hell of a job investing and, you know, marketing it and doing certain things. And we're going to start hitting the market as far as marketing it when it gets closer to documentary being finished. So I'm saying 5 to 8 months might be long.
Okay.
They're in the editing process, and you know how that goes.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
But I got a great team, and I got a great team that's believing in me, and some great people. They're doing it the right way. And, I'm excited, you know, when the finished product and to let people know my story. Because when I was in high school and growing up, we didn't have the internet.
Yes.
So this is gonna really, you know, if I had internet when I was in high school, you know, go tell them, you know, what would have happened, you know, to me. But the documentary, I think it's gonna be real. It's inspiring to not just kids but to adults also.
Exactly.
To understand how hard it is to maintain a certain level of integrity throughout all my journey.
Do you look to write a book with that too, Kenny, after the documentary's released?
I'm going to try to come. That's what I want to do. I was doing a book, but I had to stop after the documentary. A book is very difficult, very hard.
Yes.
You got to have a good team, which is a good writer. So I'm definitely going to come right after the documentary and do the book. I just been blessed that, you know, with people that's been down with me from day one, that believes in me and that respects me.
That's great. And I think that, Kenny, that story also needs to go to every AAU coach, every AAU parent that has a dream of basketball, from the suburbs to the inner city to the rural communities, that guess what? Don't push your kids so hard. And see that's going to be the life. Yes, if they have the talent, like you did, push them in a way of encouraging them and letting them lead them. And I think that's the huge thing. I was talking to Harvey Grant about this and how he had success of his kids playing in the NBA and all this. And did you push him, Harvey? And he said, no, I didn't push him, but I encouraged them once they had the gift and talent to go after and doing it. And that's the story that we have to bring out, is the pressure that you went under. We're going to see this in the documentary, Kenny, when you felt how pressured and worried at times you were, that you did not want to fail. Your fear of failing, that's going to be part of this theme for sure. And I think that's important.
Yeah, definitely. I was scared of failing. I was scared of failing out of a lawyer. I was scared of failing because if I failed out of high school, I would let my mother down and I wouldn't be able to play basketball you know, at a university. And then when I got to the NBA, I was scared of failing because I had reached a height that, you know, that most people don't make it. I wasn't good enough. It just wasn't going to be good enough for me just making an NBA. I had to maintain.
That's so true. All right, well, Kenny, I'm going to be getting... Yeah. Go ahead, sorry.
Go ahead.
No, I was saying, absolutely. And I see that, and especially myself.